Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Ron Yates, Dean of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. I'm here sitting in for Celeste Quinn, who's away on vacation. Our topic today is Vietnam, or more accurately, correspondents who covered the war in Vietnam. In the past year or so, several of those correspondents have passed away, and that got me to thinking that the world was losing a generation of really great war reporters. For example, just 2 weeks ago, we lost Kate Webb, the legendary correspondent for United Press International in Vietnam and Cambodia. Kate was one of a handful of women who covered the war in Vietnam and Cambodia. It was while she was with UPI's bureau in Phnom Penh that she was captured by the North Vietnamese, along with six other correspondents, and held for 23 days. And not long after she was captured, the body of a woman was found in the jungle, and many thought it was Kate. And the New York Times, among other papers, ran her obituary. When Kate surfaced a week or so later, she had the privilege of reading her own obituary. And with me today are two of Kate's contemporaries, Denby Fawcett, now a political reporter for KITV 4 News in Honolulu, Hawaii, and Tracy Wood, who is currently editor-in-chief of Ms. Magazine in Los Angeles. Denby, Tracy, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you.
Well, let me tell you a bit about both of you, maybe for our guests so they don't know who you are. During your tour in Vietnam, Denby Fawcett was a correspondent for the Honolulu Advertiser. Is that right, Denby?
Yes, that's right.
Right. And Tracy Wood worked for UPI in its Saigon Bureau. Both of the journalists, along with Kate Webb and six other women correspondents, contributed to an insightful book about 5 years ago titled War Torn, Stories of War from the Women Reporters Who Covered Vietnam. It was published by Random House. I guess before we go any further, I should, before we begin our conversation with our two guests, I want to remind you that you are invited to join the conversation by calling 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere you can hear us on the radio or anywhere across North America that you might be listening on the Internet. Those numbers, again, are 333-9455 or 333-WILL locally, and toll-free 1-800-222-9455 or 1-800-222-WILL. Now, I knew Kate Webb, but probably not as well as both of you did. When I arrived in Vietnam in 1974 with the Chicago Tribune, I believe she'd already left. I did know Laura Palmer fairly well, one of the other contributors to War Torn. In fact, we may have been on the same CH-53 chopper that lifted out of the MACV compound in Saigon in April of 1975. And, you know, I thought it might be helpful before we get rolling here to provide a little historical perspective for our listeners. You know, for a lot of people, Vietnam is ancient history, but for those of us who covered it, it was like yesterday. But really, few events in recent history have had the impact on the United States that the war in Vietnam did. It began in the early 1960s when President Kennedy sent in several thousand advisors, and it didn't end officially until the early hours of April 30th, 1975, when the last Americans fled Saigon during a very chaotic evacuation. Vietnam ripped the nation apart like no other event I ever witnessed before or since. It created deep and painful divisions in American society, even more, I believe, than our current involvement in Iraq has done. It also changed some people forever, and those of us who worked in Vietnam and Cambodia as correspondents, we arrived with little more than our preconceptions. Many of us left with a lot more. Deeply personal emotional baggage, horrific memories of suffering and anguish we can't forget. And as always the case with the war, a few fond recollections of people and places and events that we don't ever want to forget. Could I ask you both to tell our listeners a little bit about what Kate Webb was like, what made her such a great war reporter? How did she approach her job as a war correspondent? Either one of you can jump in here. Denby, how about you?
Well, Kate came from a different era of journalism, as did I. And this, we both came to Vietnam at about the same time in the mid-60s when the American buildup was starting to the point where we would have hundreds of thousands of soldiers there. But Kate was a quiet reporter who went about her business without pointing attention to herself. And this was one thing very different about our era, was it was before the age of celebrity journalism. and Kate would match the tenet of journalism to enter a story, come in, and leave a small footprint. The story wasn't about her. It was about the people she was covering, and she was modest and quiet and had a very soft voice and was often hard to hear.
Tracy, what are your recollections of Kate?
I think some of the things that made her stand out and kept her standing out as a war correspondent for decades were the fact that she always got very close to whoever the war was about. In the Vietnam War, she was very close to the South Vietnamese. She really learned about South Vietnam, and she learned about Cambodia. She covered the South Vietnamese military, which a lot of foreign correspondents didn't, because their news organizations back home wanted to know what the American soldiers were doing. They were not that interested in what the South Vietnamese were doing. And Kate made sure that she didn't do that. She always covered everybody. And she was just a much broader reporter than a lot of others.
And yet she went there.
Language also, which a lot of reporters in that era weren't. She was a fluent French speaker, which got her closer to older Vietnamese officers who spoke French. And she also had ability to learn other languages, so she even knew a little bit of Vietnamese.
Which is not an easy language to learn with its six tones.
No.
I know. I tried myself. And the interesting thing about Kate is that, given this, what you just described as a kind of a quiet, thoughtful individual, yet she had lots of ambition, courage. I mean, here she goes off with a one-way ticket to Vietnam, not having a job, not knowing what she was going to do when she got there, and parlayed all this into an amazing career. So it's quite remarkable, actually, what she did.
Yeah, it is. And I think that's the other part that people tended to underestimate her, because she was quiet and she spoke quietly. They tended to think that she was a quiet personality, but she clearly was not. I mean, she knew what she wanted to do, and woe betide whoever got between her and the story she wanted to cover.
No, she actually talked quite a bit. I remember having conversations, and she would talk more than people would think, but she didn't talk loudly. That was the difference, I think.
That's it, exactly. When you read these reports of Kate now, they seem, some of them, quite strange to me, that she was quiet and never talk, because Kate talked a lot and loved to tell stories and had hundreds of stories to tell, and you could sit and listen to her for hours.
Absolutely. Well, let me ask you this, both of you. What motivated you to go to Vietnam? Demby, let me start with you, because you went there, I think, in the mid-60s. And what years were you there exactly?
I was there in that period from May of 1966 through 1967. And I went back two times later up into the 70s. But, of course, the most memorable time for me was the buildup of the war, that first period.
And why? What motivated you to go there in the first place?
I wanted to go, I think, for some of the same reasons Kate did. I thought it was an incredible story, and I wanted to see what was happening, to see a war, to see what it was like, The people involved in the war, the soldiers, were about our same age. She was 23, mm-hmm. I was 24. And I think it was just this curiosity that gets a lot of people into journalism and makes them stay in journalism. You want to find out what's going on and be at the center of the activity.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a primary motivator, that's for sure. Tracy, same question. What years were you in Vietnam?
I was there from the early spring of 1972 through the spring of 1974.
Uh-huh.
It was the end of the last North Vietnamese offensive, and then through the ceasefire and the release of the POWs, and then the beginning of what we called the Vietnamese war.
The Vietnamization of the war, I guess they call it.
Yeah.
After 1973, after the peace accords in Paris.
Right.
You know, because I went there in 74, and that's, you know, it was different because there were just very few American soldiers left. There were a lot of American hangers-on and people who had retired there and were hanging out at the Brink and places like that, you know, around
right.
Saigon. But there
the
was...
contractors and the...
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. And Air America pilots and, you know, all those...
And all the spies who were running travel agencies.
Yeah. and other things.
Yes.
You know, before I go any further, Denby and Tracy, let me share with you the when Kate passed away, I began thinking about this, and I thought, gee, you know, David Halberstam just passed away, and I thought, my gosh, there are a lot of people who were there during this period that are no longer with us. And so I began doing a little bit of research, and let me share with you the roll call of some of the men and women who covered the wars in Vietnam and Cambodia, and who, in addition to Kate Webb, passed away in the past year or so. Of course, David Halberstam, who covered Vietnam for the New York Times in the early 60s, and whose early reports critical of the war had a lot to do with the way the media came to distrust the military and vice versa. Catherine Leroy, I don't know if you remember her or not, she was one of the first women combat photographers in Vietnam. She arrived in 66, and like Kate Webb, she was captured by the North Vietnamese and held. I don't know if either of you remember her.
Absolutely. Very briefly, like I think for a couple of days.
Uh-huh. And then Leon Daniel, who I'm sure you might have run into. He was for the United Press International reporter who spent 3 decades covering a lot of the world's hotspots. He died about a year ago, and he first reported Vietnam in 1966. And he was one of the few Western reporters to remain in the country after the fall of Saigon on April 30th, 1975. Did either of you know Leon?
I knew Leon very well. I worked for him. He was the bureau chief in Hong Kong when I left Vietnam and went up to Hong Kong.
That's right. Well, I knew Leon, and yeah, he was such a one of the most, I don't know, one of the nicest people I ever met in my life in this business.
He was.
Yeah. Dennis Cameron, he made his home in Los Angeles, Paris, and London, but for a time, more than anywhere, Cameron belonged to Southeast Asia. He loved Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. The countries and their people, and having initially been sent on an assignment by Time and Newsweek for a couple of months in 69, he stayed for 6 years.
Yeah, I remember him, too.
Do you? The war was... Now he had a really interesting or an amazing ability to catch all aspects of the devastation that was taking place. I mean, he could document the suffering of children in the midst of war, but he also knew how to point a camera at somebody who's carrying a gun and still finding humanity in a battle-weary face. And another person was Edward Baer, a British foreign correspondent and writer who wrote books on history and his career as a journalist. He died in Paris in 1981, just a couple of months ago. He covered conflicts all across the globe, from the French-Algerian conflict to the Vietnam War. I think probably the most famous book he wrote many, he provided a telling look at his own trade with a book that he called Anyone Here Been Raped and Speaks English? And this was taken from, he had gone to Africa to cover an event, and some BBC reporter walked into the airport where something awful had just happened and asked that question. So he used it as a title for a book because he thought it spoke volumes about our jobs and about our work. And finally, somebody that you both might have known, because I knew him, and that was Pham Xuan An. And he was a fascinating character who led a double life as a trusted reporter for a lot of Western news organizations during the war while he was spying for North Vietnam. He died in September 2006 in Saigon. He was 79. And he worked as a reporter for Reuters, and then he worked for Time magazine. And Mr. An covered American and South Vietnamese military and diplomatic events and was one of a handful of reporters admitted to the off-the-record briefings by American authorities. Time eventually made him a full staff correspondent, the only Vietnamese to be given that distinction by a major American news organization. And at the same time, Mr. An, who was a colonel in the NVA, was delivering a steady stream of military documents and reports to the North Vietnamese authorities, writing in invisible ink and leaving the material in containers at designated spots around Saigon. Amazing, you know, and I remember him very well because I remember spending a lot of time with the Time correspondent there. I don't know if you remember him or not, either of you, but interesting guy. So that's quite a lineup.
You've also left out a very interesting person who was in our book, Gloria Emerson, correspondent for the New York Times.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's right.
And she died, I think, 2 years ago by committing suicide.
Oh, my. Oh, boy. Well, you know, that's quite a group of people, and all of them had distinguished careers, Mr. Ahn notwithstanding, in our profession. So
he had two distinguished careers.
Certainly, as a spy and a journalist. Let me ask you this. What were your first impressions of Vietnam? I'd like both of you to answer that one. Maybe you first, Tracy.
I think what struck me first was the thing that surprised me the most always about Vietnam, which was how beautiful it was. I just was not prepared for that because, you know, it was coming in at the end. It had been like 10 years of war, watching it on television, reading about it, editing stories. I was working in New York before I went there, editing the copy coming over. In my head, I just had this image of constant warfare, ugliness, you know, and then just arriving, flying in even. As you were looking down, it was so green, and it looked so peaceful from the air. And you would be covering something that was absolutely awful, but if you could pick your head up and just look out, you might be seeing gorgeous beaches with a wide ocean or just beautiful fields. I mean, it just, the constant contrast of it just never left me the whole time I was there.
That's interesting, because I remember when I first got there, I looked down from the plane, and like we were flying over a heavily forested area, and I said, it reminds me of flying over a huge plate of broccoli. You know, you can't see anything except those treetops. And then when I got there and got off the plane and we began, you know, making my way into Saigon, downtown Saigon from Tan Son Nhut, what struck me is the people. I mean, I thought, my goodness, these are such friendly, wonderful people. I was just blown away by how what kind of people these were, and at the same time, extremely resilient. Denby, what were your first impressions?
Well, my first impression was arriving in Saigon was how hot it was. I come from a hot place, but we have a sea breeze here in Hawaii. There's it's total humidity. It's oppressive. You change your clothes three times a day if you can. You're just sweating from morning to night. And crowded, and then very exotic. When I was there, they were having the uprisings in the Buddhist temples, the radical monks. So you could be, I had a bicycle and be bicycling home and bicycle into tear gas, where the government was tear gassing the Buddhist temple to quiet the monks. So it was unlike any place I'd ever been. I'd been to Asia before, but I'd never lived there and never spent time and been enmeshed in the fabric of it.
Yeah, that's an interesting description, because that's one thing I remember about Vietnam was the incredible heat. You leave in the morning, maybe 7:30, 8 o'clock, and within 30 minutes you were drenched, you know, because the humidity was just incredibly high, and it was hot. You know, before I go, once again, I want to remind our listeners that you are invited to join the conversation by calling 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere you can hear us on the radio or anywhere across North America that you might be listening on the Internet. Those numbers, again, are 333-9455 or 333-WILL locally and toll-free 1-800-222-9455 or 1-800-222-WILL. Did either of you cover subsequent wars? And if so, how have things changed for women correspondents since your days in Vietnam? Either or both of you can jump in on that one.
I did not. I did not cover them. I am in contact with friends who did, and they talk about the vast differences between Vietnam and Iraq, particularly, just in terms of personal safety, if nothing else. At least in the Vietnam War, you could get, if you were in Saigon, if you were in any of the large cities, you're reasonably safe. You could go out to dinner at night. You could do certain things. You could walk from your apartment a block to the office. And in Iraq, the personal safety is just non-existent from what friends are telling me.
There are some clear differences between Vietnam and other wars, and I've only covered a war in Haiti after that, and that was, you know, so strange it's not even comparable. But there are three just very clear differences, and which tend us to make us say now, like a lot of people do in A Human Thing, it was the good old days of journalism. In Vietnam, there was no censorship, and you could go. Another thing is you could go wherever you wanted if you had the permission of a military commander with whose group you wanted to be. And then the other thing that made it better for me, because I don't like to be with hundreds of reporters on any story, there were fewer reporters. You could go out, like I stayed with a platoon once for a week just by myself with no other people. And then, of course, the change in technology, you had longer to think about what you wanted to write before you transmitted it. You know, there were no sat phones.
No, you know what? That's an excellent point. That's one of the things I tell my students when I talk about. I teach a class in international reporting, and I tell them that this technology today is wonderful. However, what I really enjoyed about my time as a reporter in the 70s and even into the 80s was that I could call my office if I could get through to them, or send them a telex and say, I'm going to go up country. I'll be gone for 3 or 4 days. I'll call you when I get back, you know. And then you could actually go up and report a story, talk to people, think about it, consider what you've seen, make some sense out of it, and come back and write something that made some kind of sense for the reader. And I think that's what's missing today.
You just have the crushing deadlines. I mean, you had time to think about what you saw and really to try and describe it much better.
Right. Now I think we have a caller from Eureka. You're on the line with Tracy Wood and Demby Fawcett. Go ahead.
Thank you. An interesting conversation. I remember the term credibility gap that emerged, I believe, in the 1960s from the Johnson administration. And I know it's probably self-evident, but I'm wondering what your guess view of what the government was putting out and what you saw. In your point of view, was there that great a chasm between what was the government was said and what you really experienced?
Demby, you want to tackle that one?
Sure. Yes, and that expression was so funny. I had a friend that used to wear a little button that said, I was ambushed at the credibility gap. But anyhow, the military had its version, and that could be had any evening in a briefing in Saigon that was nicknamed the 5 o'clock follies. Mm-hmm. But the difference in Vietnam is you had a chance to actually get out and see what was going on. So we would mainly go to this official press briefing to meet up with our friends when we were back in Saigon and see who was going out to dinner where and where what we could do in the evening, and that was considered more of a social event then. So the military had its line, but we had access and availability to see what was going on, and that was why the reporting was the way it was. You got a lot of interesting, detailed reports of how life in Vietnam was different from that official report.
Tracy, you want to jump in on that one?
Yeah, the other thing that they did, I don't know if they did this the whole time, but at the time I was there, not only were they doing this briefing for the reporters, but they were doing it for the Pentagon generals back in Washington, and there was a live line so that the generals in Washington were hearing the briefing as it was taking place in Vietnam. And so the briefers, the American briefers in Vietnam, were constantly being second-guessed by the generals in Washington as to why they answered a question the way they did, why they didn't say this, why they didn't. And these were generals who were not on the scene and who had a point of view they wanted to get across because the administration did.
Mm-hmm.
And they were being second-guessing their colonels, basically, who were doing the briefings, who were talking to reporters, many of them who had just come back from the field and had seen things that were contrary to what the briefers were trying to say. There was this constant thing, fortunately or unfortunately, but over body counts, because it was just this endless, impossible debate about how many people died. Whatever it was, a reporter would see so many people dead and come back, and the briefers would say twice that many North Vietnamese were killed and half that many Americans were killed, and those kinds of things, when people would see them firsthand and count, that's what sort of led in a lot of ways to these credibility gaps, with just really basic things that you could see and document weren't being done right.
Those are good points. Thank you for your call.
Could I ask one more question, please, sir?
Go ahead.
What is the, and I'll get off the air, what is the panel's point of view about the embedding of reporters in the Iraq War?
Good question.
Thank you.
Good question.
Can I answer that?
Yeah, either one of you. Go ahead.
I think it's one of the worst things that has ever happened to journalism in the United States, or actually to the military as well. It's one of the worst disservices that's been done, is the embedding. It absolutely changes the way the war is reported. I don't know. I mean, I can understand the military, some military leadership wanting that, but it is not. It has done a terrible service to the public.
No, that's a good point. I mean, you should identify yourself. I should have asked you who you were, so the audience knows who was talking.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Tracy.
Hi, Tracy. Well, look, you know, that's a good point, because, you know, in Vietnam, the thing that about covering that war, I mean, look, covering any war is dangerous. I mean, there's no such thing as covering a safe war. That's just impossible. But in Vietnam, at least, you could go any place you wanted. You'd jump on a chopper and say, where are you going? Well, I'm going here. I'm going out to the Parrot Speak, or I'm going, you know, to Tainan Province or whatever. And you would go. And then you would stay out as long as you could, or as long as that unit was going to stay out there, or you made your way back any way you possibly could. The under the rubric, or kind of the excuse of, we want to keep journalists safe, which is not anything I've ever asked any military person to do for me.
Exactly right.
They say, well, we're going to embed you, so you'll be with one unit. And then, you know, the idea here is, it's not because you'll be safe, it's because we know where you are and we can watch you at all times, you know. And I think that's really...
One problem with embedding also is, if you're with the unit, you become part of that unit.
Yes.
You have to be. And then you tend to be less objective. You're a member of the unit. That's the way the military structure works.
Exactly right.
And if they don't like what you write, then they can't find a place to embed you.
That's right.
And then that happens.
Yes, it does. And but I know Iraq is a different war from Vietnam. I know it's a very dangerous thing to be covering, and I know that people have trouble getting out of the green zone, and you've got to have all this security. But I think to myself, if I were a reporter and I were in Baghdad, and I'm speaking here from Urbana, I'm not speaking from Baghdad, I just couldn't imagine myself staying in my hotel and sending somebody else out to do the reporting. I just couldn't work that way. I would say, bring me home. This is not how you cover a war, you know.
No.
But I understand the concern about safety, and I understand that, you know, that journalists are targets, and they are captured, and they are, you know, things happen to them, and it's not a pleasant thing to be a part of. But you know what happened in Cambodia, too? The Khmer Rouge always killed journalists when they caught them, normally.
That's right.
So
they killed a lot of them.
Yes, they did.
Let me
here's one for both of you to tackle. Do you think women cover wars differently from your male counterparts? I mean, do you see things that men don't see, or feel things that men don't feel in the same situation? Tracy, let me ask you that one first.
Actually, no, I don't. I think both men and women change when they cover wars. And what I mean by that is, I have seen men write extraordinarily sensitive, bring-you-to-tears stories covering a war that they would never write if they were back on the police beat or something else. They'd be too macho.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're covering a war, the war itself is so much more important than the individuals covering it, that it gives them a freedom to write in a way that they might not at other times. I think for women, what may happen is that we were talking about two different eras.
Mm-hmm.
At the time that Demby and I were doing it, it was not normal for women to cover a war.
No.
Now, I think most of the reporters are women. From at least, I would say at least half of them are women covering Iraq right now. And I think what everybody else has learned is that women can cover a, quote, masculine war as well as any man could, both the hard parts of it and the sensitivity parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
That
yep.
runs into what we're talking about today, the difference between covering Vietnam and future wars, and the hard part for women in covering Vietnam War was to convince a male unit commander that you could do it, that you wouldn't, you know, fall apart and collapse or want to write stories about only the beautiful parts of it. Or there was such a stereotype about women and women reporters that I think the victory for women in Vietnam, women reporters, was showing that they could cover the war and could do it.
I think it was a turning point for women and this type of work. I think that it surprised a lot of people. I think a lot of the male correspondents, or even up until the end when I was there in 74 and 75, weren't convinced that that women had a place there. But, you know, you met someone like Kate, you met some people, you know, like Georgianne Geyer, or you met some people like, I remember a woman named, you might remember her, Claire Hollingworth from the Daily Telegraph in London, who knew more about military ordnance than anybody I've ever met in my life. You know, she could listen and tell you exactly what the incoming was, what kind of a range it had. She knew everything about all the ordnance used in war. Both of you obviously poured a lot of yourselves into the chapters you wrote in War Torn, the book that was published a few years ago. And Kate did too. And there's one passage that she wrote that goes like this. After the war, a lot of us survivors had trouble with what I call lack of bridges to cross or rafts to hang on to, the time to get us safely over the post-Vietnam time. What do you both think she meant by that? Denby, what do you think she meant by that?
I think what she meant is when you come back, there's no one you can talk to about what you've seen that you can hang on to that can help you make some sense of it. That you're, and this was, too, before the era of post-trauma counseling, and which they still don't really have for reporters, but reporters have sometimes seen more than some soldiers when they went out day after day after day, which Kate was very interested in covering the combat side of the war, and it's, you come back to a vacuum.
Tracy, what do you think she meant by that?
I think I agree with her. I think just a story about what happened in Hong Kong after the war, I felt really sorry for the British military or police authorities, because a whole bunch of the war correspondents wound up based in Hong Kong to cover the rest of Asia after the war. And it was too tame. They hadn't gotten the adrenaline out of their system. They hadn't dealt with all the stuff. And they were still ready to go whenever anything happened. And I remember one bank robbery. It was just an ordinary bank robbery, but the bank robber, for some reason, holed up inside the bank, and the police put out a little notice saying that there was bank robbery. And the whole foreign correspondence delegation descended on this bank robbery. It was like the only thing that had happened in months that came close to satisfying this adrenaline need or this, get this out of my system. The other thing is that they used to shoot off the noonday gun in Hong Kong, and you could always tell the reporters who came up right away from Saigon, because they jumped and, just literally jumped when the noonday gun went off.
Oh, yeah. You hit the ground. I remember one time I went to Chicago after the fall of Saigon, and I was walking across the Michigan Avenue Bridge, and a truck backfired on that bridge, and I was on my belly within seconds.
Exactly.
And the entire noonday crowd looked at me like I was nuts.
I think there are dirty shirts from one end of the world to the other from foreign correspondents who hit the ground for, just exactly that. I don't know how Kate actually ever resolved that, because there were some reporters who couldn't. They just had to have that adrenaline flow, and they just went from, one war to another, or one dangerous situation to another because they didn't feel like they were alive unless they were covering something that was very dangerous.
No, I think that's very true. There are people, and I think there's something happens to you. You go out and you're involved in some combat and some conflicts or whatever, and you're being shot at and you're surviving and you're doing it over and over and over again. And finally, I think at some point you begin to think, well, somehow I'm immune to this. Nothing's going to actually touch me, you know. And that's when it gets really dangerous then, because then you begin taking a lot of stupid chances and you'll get into trouble.
One thing with Kate that helped her resolve some of it, I think, is she was very helpful and kind to people that she met in the later years.
Mm-hmm.
And she adopted a family in Afghanistan, and she spent her own money for a driver in Korea who wasn't making enough salary at AFP, her news agency. She just paid him with part of her salary. She was always looking
Amazing.
After people. Right. Maybe that was her own way of looking after herself.
Mm-hmm.
The I think it's the India and Asian News Service in their obit about Kate. They talked about I think the sentence, sort of a throwaway sentence in the middle of the obit, was something like, she was different from many other Western journalists because she did not have an air of superiority.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of how Kate dealt with things, is she was not arrogant. Let's put it this way. She was not arrogant with the people she covered and the people she worked with.
No, that's exactly right. We have another caller on line one. Go ahead, and you're on the on.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, go ahead.
As you speak, I think of Iraq, the reporters in Iraq and how they were in Vietnam. And I think about, and I question the idea of integrity of the reporters when you know that you're being lied to or there are omissions and distortions. The whole idea of responsibility to the truth and speaking up when you know that the story isn't coming out the way it should come out. I remember the documentary with McNamara where he said he knew we were losing the war, we were sending over soldiers and there were deaths, and still went along with it. When do you stop and say this is wrong? I mean, I'm not questioning you mm-hmm. individually, but how long do you put up with that?
Tracy, you want to...
What do you do about those things? It's really very, very significant for what's going on in Iraq and what happened.
That's a good question. Let's let our guests answer that. Tracy, you want to jump in on there?
I think what a reporter does, because we're not opinion makers in the sense of having an opinion that we're trying to get across people, if you see something and it doesn't look like you're being told the truth, you go after what are the facts. And the whole underpinning of journalism is if you give the public the right information, they will make the right decisions. And it's not up to us to tell them how to think. It's up to us to get them the right information. So when you have, it doesn't actually even matter if it's a war like Iraq or a war like Vietnam or any kind of public issue that you're covering as a reporter, if you get a sense that the people who are in charge are not giving you accurate information, it's not a personal thing with you. It means they're not giving the public accurate information.
Well, did you speak up, or did you know people who did?
No. I mean, not my role as a reporter to speak up. It's my role as a reporter to find out what's true. And if they're not telling the truth, then, yeah, you ask a lot of questions, and you keep asking the questions, and you go to other people and get asked questions, and you look for documentation. You do everything you can to get to the truth, but you do not, in my experience, I mean, my philosophy, you do not get into arguments. You don't try and challenge them and say, hey, I know you're not telling me the truth. Does that happen? Yeah, you lose your cool periodically. Everybody does, but as a way of working, no. I mean, that's really, whenever that happened, I always felt like I'd failed.
Well, your duty is to go and try and find the truth, and that's often very hard. But it's interesting you mentioned McNamara, because when our book came out, Laura Palmer and I were sent to a media coach because we were going to be on the Today Show to pitch our book. And the lady who was coaching us told me that McNamara had been sent to her when his book came out. And she asked him, why are you coming to me? Why do you need media coaching before you appear on these network shows? And he said because he was afraid that he was going to cry when he got on TV. And he knew that would be so horrible because all of the families of dead Vietnam soldiers would be throwing their beer cans at the television set. But I think he waited a very, very long time to tell the truth, and I think it was very hard for him until the end.
Mm. You know, one of the one of your colleagues who is also a contributor to War Torn is Tad Bartimus, and she worked for AP, Saigon, and Phnom Penh bureaus from 73 to 74. She wrote, really, I thought, a really interesting passage that I'd like to get both of your comments on, and this was in the book War Torn. She says, what I miss most about Vietnam is knowing the rules. In country, I had a clear understanding of what I could or could not do. I learned fast that love, honor, and friendship were all that mattered. I lived in the moment because it was all that I had. I almost never worried about dying, though I was constantly terrified of snakes. Life was verbs, eat, sleep, hurt, hold, love, work, surrender, leave. Now I live in, but not of, a world that overwhelms me. I often turn away from its complexity, speed, and surfeit of information, because I learned in Vietnam that the worth of a life isn't measured in money or power or possessions or status. I'm out of step with most of the people around me. I distrust authority. I am not a team player or a go-along-to-get-along gal. What do you both think of that that statement?
I think it's beautifully written, and I think that the main point is that in a war, covering a war, everything is so clear. I mean, when you have the thought hanging over you that you might die tomorrow, the important things become important. You don't get caught up in the little small minutia of life like we do now, which makes it seem so confusing because we have so many things to worry about. They're much fewer. Stay alive, see your friends, you know, have a good time when you can and do a good job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what? Just as a quick, we're almost running out of time here, but I wanted to ask you both, what were the lessons about journalism and life that each of you learned from your experiences in Vietnam? Demby, what did you learn from that experience?
I think I learned to value the moment, to value my friends, to value the people I love, to try not to be petty and superficial. And then for writing, for journalism, to not be afraid. If you want to do something, to go ahead and do it, even though you're scared and think you can't.
Mm. Tracy?
I think very similar things. I grew up a lot faster. I mean, you just have to. Everybody who sees a war grows up. I don't know that you grow up better, but I think you are... There's a value to community, to other people, that I think stays with you. Maybe you would have had it anyway. Maybe you would have developed it. But the care and welfare of other people, I think, becomes something that just stays with you for the rest of your life.
Well said, I think, both of you. You know, it's sad to say goodbye to colleagues, and I'm not sure the general public realizes how close the bond is among war correspondents. People who've shared and reported tragedy are inextricably linked, I think, by their experiences. And sometimes they're outcasts. They're viewed with suspicion by the military, with disdain by governments and dictators and despots, and misunderstood by the public. And, you know, they are thought of by some as swaggering, arrogant egomaniacs who, as I think Tom Stoppard once wrote, I think the most important part of any story is the fact that they have arrived to cover it, you know. In fact, I like what Kate Webb said in 2002 about working as a war correspondent. And this is, to me, very telling. She said, and I think this was actually at an interview in Hong Kong, people always think I must be so tough to survive all of this, but I'm a real softy. But maybe that's what it takes. You have to be soft to survive. Hard people shatter. So with that, I want to thank you both, Denby Fawcett and Tracy Wood, for being with us today, and thank you for listening. This is Ron Yates, Dean of the College of Communications, saying ciao, which is goodbye in Vietnamese.